Good morning. So, last time we talked about bit manipulation, finished up after talking a bit about shifts, ways of exposing that. Well, in hardware, we can have a bunch of wires containing the bits of a value. We can easily just look at certain wires, but that operation wasn't so easy with our traditional assembly, so we had this shifting operation to allow us to actually select particular bits and move them to a more convenient location in our registers. Gave us the equivalent of that functionality and turned out to be really easy to implement in hardware. And we talked about how for other things, we want to do things to certain bits. We have these bitwise operations, which again, really easy in hardware. We have our basic sort of building block of hardware computations, the gate. We basically just have a big array of gates in the most straightforward hardware implementation. And then we talked about doing certain tasks with this. We went through the example of implementing the ternary operator without the conditionals that the obvious implementation would have, what that would look like, and saw about this general divide and conquer strategy, and that we could do multiple operations in parallel to get something more efficient than our sort of naive solution for oring all the bits of a value together. And just talk generally about bit puzzles, which will be next week's lab and follow-up homework. So any questions about what we covered last time? Okay, so a logistical note. There's a post quiz which will be released tonight. It's at 6 p.m., so I have enough time to like write it and make sure it reflects what I got to in lecture and not stuff I didn't. Got to both lectures, not stuff I didn't, and there will be a pre-quiz on next week's reading released Saturday. Just reminding you, because I know people forget. So also, when we talked about bit manipulation, we looked at the set of operators, bitwise and or XOR, left shift and right shift, and these are the ones which get the most attention, since, I mean, they're pretty widely implemented, and you can access them in C. But there are some common bit manipulation instructions that a lot of processors have decided to implement because they come up a lot and they turn out to be pretty, either in some cases, tricky to do without a dedicated instruction relative to how easy they are to implement in hardware. So one example of that is this first or last bit set. It's relatively easy to make hardware that looks probably similar to how the checking of zero works to find out where's the first bit set and the number of the last bit set. And that's pretty annoying to do with bitwise operators. The straightforward way is like if you want to find the first bit set in a 64-bit number, you check all the bits. There's faster ways, but using the parallelism we talked about, but it's still not great compared to what relatively simple hardware can do, and it turns out it's common. There's some other operations like that. One is counting the number of bits that are set. You know, pretty easy in hardware, relatively speaking. Another is swapping bytes, so changing from big to little endian or vice versa. Another common operation is rotate, which is like shift, but instead of shifting the values off the end and bits off the end and getting rid of them, you put them back at the beginning. And this, in hardware, I gather, like you can easily make a piece of hardware which either does a shift or a rotate, so it's not too expensive for hardware to implement that. So just mentioning that these exist, even though they don't have things in C, you know, so C made a particular choice of the operators they would expose, probably based on what was common on hardware at the time, but it's not the only choice of things that you might want to have, you know, hardware support to expose that it's really bits and it's easy to manipulate them in hardware. Okay, and today our main topic is not going to be bit manipulation, but sort of instruction set choices in general. How do we, you know, design our assembly language and the corresponding encoding and machine code, and what concerns do we have? And here we see an example of some concerns where people said, well, these operations are either really convenient or easy to implement in hardware, and that's sort of what provoked them. We'll look at some of those concerns today. And we're talking about instruction set architecture. So first, you've heard about instruction set architectures. We'll define the term a bit because we've kind of seen the term and haven't really said, like, what does it mean? But there are a lot of these things we'll call ISAs, or instruction set architectures. You've heard of x86, seen that. Assembly, that's like our most common desktop, laptop, server architecture these days. You've possibly heard about ARM, which is the most common instruction set in the mobile and embedded space. Things like cell phones. And there's a whole bunch of others, and these are just ones which actually are still being made, to my knowledge. So we have Power. If you remember PowerPC, back when Apple made chips that weren't used in non-Intel chips, that's what this architecture was. It's still manufactured. IBM uses it. The Wii U used it. MIPS is an architecture which our book talks about as the foundation of what we'll call RISC that we'll talk about. It's still around. It's pretty common in Wi-Fi access points you might buy. It's one of the most common architectures used in there. Like, some of them use ARM, some of them use MIPS. Those are the most common choices you'll see. And there's Spark, which used to be, if you remember, Sun Microsystems. Heard about that company? Brought by Oracle. This was Sun, the main architecture Sun used. Oracle still manufactures some of it. And Fujitsu, and makes supercomputers, basically clusters of machines in for the mostly, I guess, Japanese government, Japanese companies that use this architecture. There's the Z architecture, which is the IBM mainframe architecture. IBM hasn't stopped manufacturing mainframes using an instruction set that's derived from the one they were using in the 60s. They still make new chips for them. We have very different architectures. So we have the Z80, if you know the TI. This is the chip that uses. It was made in the 70s. They still make the same chip. Haven't felt a need to change. And we have some various other architectures. Shark, sort of digital signal processing, like audio processing, and RISC-V, which is, you know, if I got to choose the architecture we used for courses at this institution, would probably be that one, because it's pretty clean, and it's more open source. And a lot of, like, you might say, like, why are there so many architectures? And part of it is that people look at the existing architecture and say, I can do better for me. And come up with that. Part of it is that companies like develop things for an architecture and they're not going to change that. Like, I don't think IBM thinks, yeah, we really nailed the IBM mainframe instruction set in the 60s. That's not why they're still using it. It's because they have it, they're going to keep using it. And the same is arguably true with x86. Okay. So there's this big variety of instruction sets that are still out there. And I'm not going to say any one of them is better or worse, but we're going to look at sort of the factors that go into, like, what differentiates these, like, how are they different, and what choices might have motivated that. So to talk about that, we need to talk about what is actually part of the instruction set. And there's two concepts we'll talk about, which are microarchitecture and instruction set. So microarchitecture is the actual design of the hardware. So, for example, Intel has many chips they call, like, Xeon or i7, but they have these generations. Each of those generations has a different hardware design, and in some cases, a very different hardware design. But it still has the same assembly language. It accepts, runs the same programs unmodified as the other things. It implements the same instruction set that is the same interface visible by software. So there's full software compatibility, but there's lots of different implementations of that. And it might be the case that internally, some of the implementations are very different. But the only way you'll know this is by things like performance and efficiency. You know, those are the sorts of differences that will be visible to a normal user between the different microarchitectures that implement the same single interface. And this is an important distinction, because It turns out that you can change the microarchitecture an awful lot. And this has happened. So if we think of x86, the original x86 way back in the 80s, you know, did not use instruction design, microarchitecture design techniques we'll talk about later in class. Used a very different design, and they've ported it over to things that are more recent that they found are faster. So for example, the original x86 ran one instruction at a time. And the more recent x86 runs lots of instructions in parallel at a time, even though it's the same instruction set. And that's a difference in microarchitecture. It's a difference in performance. But they provide the same interface when they're doing that. It looks like it behaves the same, basically, as that original machine as far as like what happens, what things go in registers, and so on. Okay, so we're going to talk about instruction sets today. And later on, we're going to start talking about microarchitectures when we talk about how do you build a machine that implements this in any possible way. And then we'll move on to talking about how do we do that more efficiently and talk about variations in microarchitecture designs. So how do these lots of different ISAs vary? So one of the most obvious ways to look at an instruction set is to look at sort of three attributes. So one is the machine code. In the machine code, how much space do we use per instruction? And that's what I have here as the instruction length. Another thing to look at is how many general purpose registers do we have, like the R registers on x86. So we have 16 of them on 64-bit x86. And that's a choice that varies between architectures. Another thing to look at is like just how many instructions do they have? So how many basically, add, subtract, move, and so on, how many of those are there? So on this chart, I have tried to count these up for a wide variety of architectures. But some of the counting is a bit weird. So for number of normal registers, I sometimes had to make some judgment calls on is this really a general purpose register or not. That's usually straightforward. For number of instructions, sometimes it's tricky to count. Like is add long and add quad word, add 32-bit, add 64-bit, are those different instructions or are those the same instruction? So there's a judgment call there, so that's why it's approximate, because we're not saying, I'm not going to make a definite thing about whether those are different instructions or not. But you can see we have this big variety, so yeah.
So what are the examples of non-general purpose, which ones would you consider general? For the registers, what's like considered general versus non-general?
So what is an example of a non-general register? So for example, x86 has registers used for floating point. And I'm not including those in the number of normal registers, even though you can use the registers that 64-bit x86 typically uses for floating point to store normal integers. And some other architectures have things like that. Yeah.
I just had a question about just looking at the power 8 instruction set.
Yeah.
I noticed that it has like the it adopts the convention of having a fixed byte length for instructions.
Yeah.
So then it has like 1400 instructions.
Yes. So the question is we'll talk later on about RISC versus CISC, but there's some notion here that you're saying, well, okay, having fixed length instructions, that makes things simpler. So clearly that should be simpler across the board, and that's not what happens. And a lot of what happens is that you don't start designing your instruction set and say, I'm going to have 1,000 instructions. That's not what anyone does. What happened for all these instruction sets we see here, which have over 1,000 instructions, is generally that someone designed a base instruction set and they kept extending it and extending it over the years. There were different versions. So power 8 is a hint. There were probably power 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And lots of things got added over time. And the same is true with x86. x86 is derived from older versions of x86. And those instructions were added over time. And that's usually what has happened. and there's various reasons you might decide that these new instructions are useful. You might change your mind later, but a big thing with these instruction sets is that they stay around forever. Like, I gave the example of the IBM mainframes, like Z architecture is compatible with the old 60s mainframes. You know, that sort of backwards compatibility happens all the time. If you think of x86, x86 chips are still trying to be somewhat compatible with these designs from the 80s. And if you want to be compatible, well, you can't get rid of those instructions. But it might be the case that maybe when you're designing your hardware, when you're choosing your microarchitecture, you say, huh, these instructions, they aren't very useful, so I don't really care if I implement them fast. You know, that's not part of the instruction set, is whether they're fast instructions. I'll just implement them in some way on my modern design because we've learned they're not useful, but I still want to maintain the same interface. And that's probably a thing which happens a bunch for some of the more obscure instructions.
Why would America still be compatible to like something from the 60s? There's still things that like use.
So the question is, why would it matter to be compatible with something from the 60s? So this is an interesting question. So, like, and it seems that like a lot of academics thought, and this is one of the things that we'll learn is behind simplifying instruction sets, is that, well, everyone's using compilers. Can't we just recompile everything? You know, can't we just change our instruction set, recompile everything? And that like seems like it's something which should work, but practically speaking, people expect to run their old programs, especially if they're like a business, and keep running them. Or run their old software in general and have it still work. And there are solutions to deal with this, like virtual machines, for example. You know, might be able to deal with that, but they aren't as good as running it, quote unquote, natively. So it's been a big priority for hardware manufacturers to do that. I think largely they just think, you know, they can easily sell a chip which runs your old software better. They can't easily sell a chip where you have to do something to run your old software. Yeah. So the question is, do people design ISA first or do they design microarchitecture first? It's probably a mix. So often the ISA will be designed with a microarchitecture in mind. Not always. Like you could just design an ISA, from scratch, but usually people will have a microarchitecture in mind because there will be decisions they'll need to make, and we'll talk about some of them later. These include some of them, which will affect their ISA design. And one example is actually this instruction length column. So if we think of the instruction length, if we have a fixed instruction length, this is going to make our microarchitecture simpler. So people who are designing with a fixed instruction length, they might be doing that because they're thinking, I want my microarchitecture to look in a particular way where that's going to be a lot easier for me. So they're like sort of co-designing aspects of it. So we have this big variety in architectures. I have asterisks where the value is questionable. So for example, ARM version 7, I say instructions are 4 bytes. It turns out that there's exceptions to that, depending on what you consider part of ARM version 7. And the same is true with RISC-V. And for Itanium, I say 41 bits. Obviously, something really weird is going on there. Okay, so these are the most obvious choices, and we can see we have this big variety in the choices for the number of registers, like how many instructions you require to implement, which means like how much stuff your processor needs to have in a certain sense, and how we encode instructions, just from the highest level. There's some other choices that other instruction sets make that might be a little less glaring, but have a big effect. So one choice is about condition code. So we learned that x86 uses this idea of condition codes, that we have these compare or arithmetic instructions that set these special registers, and then we have these conditional jump instructions that use them. Some instruction sets have said, I don't want to have these hidden registers, so I'm not going to do that. Instead, one thing that's pretty common is you can have a say branch if equal instruction. And this is basically that whole thing is one instruction. And on these architectures, typically there's no condition codes. Instead, this is how you do all branches. And that means there's a version of this for less than, greater than, or something that lets you do that in some other way. So questions about idea? Okay. So another big choice is addressing modes. So these addressing modes is a term for, if I have instructions, what ways can I specify operands? And in x86, we have an awful lot. So in x86, for example, we can specify memory locations in this way. We can specify constants as operands. We can specify labels. And we can specify addresses as operands, so which also is equivalent to a label as an operand. Like, so we have those ways, and the choice of what ways are there to do that varies between architectures. And you've learned x86, which has a ton of addressing modes relative to many of the other things on that table earlier. So some have less. And even though x86 has a ton of addressing modes, because we learned that we have this general form and all the options where you omit each part, so that's like a ton of ways of doing it. And if those of you, some of you in the BOM lab learned about segment registers, which add to this even more, there's things that other architectures do which might be different decisions. So for example, in ARM, you can specify as an operand to like your add instruction, I want a value shifted by a constant. Like that's an operand to the add instruction, or any, or lots of instructions on ARM. They just decided that's a useful thing, just like accessing memory as part of the add is. And that's just a design decision they made because they felt that that would make it easier for compilers to generate good code. Another example, so an old architecture called VAX, which we'll talk about in a bit, had an addressing mode where not only could you specify an address in a register, you could specify the address of an address in a register. So you could specify to go to a register, read an address from there, read from that memory location, interpret that as an address, and get the value you're actually passing to the instruction from that final address. So like a double pointer in direction, in an instruction. Because they felt that that was useful. But obviously, you know, this is a choice where we're figuring out what's convenient for our assembly programmers, and also, of course, we're committing to somehow implementing this in hardware. And the choice of which of these to provide is like a big part of your ISA, because this affects all your instructions. You have to figure out how to encode this. So like one of the things that is the disadvantage of x86 supporting this is that now all our instructions need a way of encoding all the possibilities. And that's complicated in a lot of ways. So another big choice is the number of operands. So far, you've seen x86, where we have two operands, you know, add, source, and destination, where the destination is also a source. Some instruction sets say, gosh, that's really inconvenient because I sure don't like doing move RAX to RBX and then, you know, add R10 RBX whenever I want to compute like A plus RAX plus R10 into a new register. I just want to do that with one instruction. So sometimes they have one instruction for that, but the disadvantage of this is now we need to fit the names of three registers in our machine code and not just two all the time. But the advantage is that now we're not generating move instructions. That might be easier or anything. And another big choice is just how complicated the instructions are. So for example, x86 has a bunch of instructions that write multiple values at once. So for example, push modifies the stack pointer and memory. And pop modifies two registers, the stack pointer and the register you're popping into. that x86 has a move s instruction, which there's variants of for bytes, words, and so on, which copies from one memory location to another and updates a counter. So, yeah. Like, these are complicated instructions. And some architectures choose to have instructions like these. And you can think, yeah, push is a really handy instruction. And some don't. And the advantage of not having them, of course, is that, well, your hardware might be easier to implement if you can count on the number of things each instruction writes being one, for example. As we'll learn later, that might save a lot of complexity. Okay. And there's other things that might make instructions complex. So one of the things we went over in the reading was about reduced instruction set computers, or RISC, which was compared to CISC, the complex instruction set computer. So I'm going to talk about what that means. And our textbook has this explanation of it, and which goes over what they think are attributes of these RISC instruction sets. I don't think it goes to sort of the heart of sort of what was happening at the time that RISC was being developed as far as what instruction sets looked like. So we're going to look at VAX. And VAX is sort of the canonical example of a complex instruction set computer, the sort of thing the designers of RISC were deciding definitely not to do. They thought that VAX was going in the wrong direction, and they wanted to do something very different. So here are some real VAX instructions with their assembly syntax. I'll let you give you a minute to read those. These are real instructions. Yeah.
Where are these implemented in the hardware?
We'll talk about that next. It's a good question. Okay, so I think most of you have time to read some of these. So we have some really complicated instructions here. We have string in string as an instruction. And if you think about implementing that in something like C, like that's a loop. And it accesses an arbitrarily large amount of memory because, you know, our length is like an integer. Yeah. We have evaluate a polynomial. Again, we have a length that's an integer, and this is a loop if you think of writing the equivalent C code. We have like a printf-like function, which is our edit PCs, like at something like sprintf. Implemented as an instruction. And so one thing you might say is, why were they doing this? Wouldn't you just use a library function? At this time, it was very common to write assembly code by hand. And probably a big part of the reason was that compilers were not nearly as good as they are today. You know, compilers would often do a bad job. And these instructions are clearly designed to help you write assembly code. Like, these are great if you're writing assembly. I mean, look at how much time you're saving with this match C instruction over writing your string in string function. But there's a good question of like, okay, we have these instructions in our instruction set, but now I need to build a machine which executes them. What could that possibly look like? Now, we haven't talked in detail about how machines work, but I'm going to give the very high level overview of how this works, and this is using a technique known as microinstructions. So basically, a typical VAX machine would be implemented by having a lookup table for each of the instructions, which would look up some simpler instructions in that table that would actually execute the assembly instruction. So there was this conversion step which sort of interpreted the instructions, and that was the hardware implementation technique. And that's how they could build hardware which actually implemented instructions like this, is that the hardware had this sort of macro language, and they just converted with a lookup to interpret the instructions and do multiple operations and do little loops and things like that in this other sort of micro instruction language, as they would call it. But there was an observation about this, of things which happen. So one thing is that because we're converting this to micro instructions, that you're really depending on this for this instruction to be useful, that whoever implemented MatchC chose the like fastest set of micro instructions. And sometimes it turned out that they didn't. You know, that they implemented it, but you know, you could be more clever in implementing it. And you could get close to that performance if you just used normal instructions that weren't like MatchC, which had their different micro instructions that ended up being faster because there was something complicated going on. We depended on that. So this is sort of one observation the risk people made, is that these complex instructions were not significantly faster, sometimes slower, but at least were not significantly faster because all that was really happening is you had this preprocessing step that did this lookup, and we were really doing these simple instructions. And they were harder to implement because even though you had this nice flexible mechanism of having this these simpler instructions that you just had a table of, you still needed to test all of that. You need to implement it, and obviously that's like not like a normal assembly language. It's a lot harder to deal with and debug. And there was a big tech trend going on, which is that people weren't writing assembly anymore. You know, people were starting to use compilers. People were starting to believe that they could write large pieces of software with compilers and not be disappointed that the compiler produced horrible code all the time. So they wanted to buy into the notion that, well, compilers are getting better, and we really want to focus on implementing these simple instructions well that are going to affect our performance. And if everyone's using compilers, we can just use a new instruction set and require compiler modifications rather than trying to be compatible with this old assembly language. So RISC was reacting to this sort of complexity and just saying, well, if we have these simple operations and that's what we expose to the users, if we have compilers, they can just work with that. And we can implement the hardware in a more efficient way. So the big idea with RISC, it's reduced because we have fewer and simpler instructions. That we're going to implement some simple instructions very well, rather than implementing a lot of instructions, maybe not as well, like the VAX machine was doing. And because we have fewer simpler instructions, it's going to be easier to build efficient hardware. And that's where we, as hardware designers, are going to spend our time. We're going to spend our time figuring out how can I make hardware that does these simple operations really fast. And there's some things which come out of this which are typical properties of RISC, some of which our textbook talks about. So one is separate instructions to access memory. That it turns out that especially for the hardware techniques they were thinking about at the time they were designing the RISC instruction set, that accessing memory and doing a computation on what you accessed from memory was a lot more complicated than just accessing registers. So they didn't want to do that very often, so they have separate instructions to access memory, where the idea is that this keeps all instructions basically equally simple. They typically have fixed length instructions. So since they have fewer, simpler instructions, they want to have those instructions be, you know, fast for the hardware to interpret. So they're going to make them fixed length so the hardware can easily figure out where each instruction is. It doesn't have to do any processing to do that, you know, like would happen with the VAX, where because the VAX has so many instructions and also supports a lot of addressing modes, like you couldn't afford to have a fixed length instruction set very easily. Now, a disadvantage of fixed length instructions and sort of something they were depending on is that fixed length instructions and simpler instructions mean that your programs are going to be bigger. They're going to take up more space. They're going to take up more space because now your add instruction, you know, if all your instructions are 4 bytes, it's 4 bytes. Doesn't matter that you don't actually have 4 bytes of stuff in there because you have like the this is an ad and two register names, and that doesn't take up 4 bytes, it's going to take up 4 bytes. So you're going to waste some space. And you're going to waste some space relative to something like fax because you don't have this one instruction which does this big operation. That match C is going to become a big loop. But they were saying that they're going to use the extra space to make accessing memory and feeding in instructions faster. So that shouldn't be an issue, was the hope. But that is a compromise they are making. Their code is getting bigger. And that compromise is one of the reasons why you saw a variable length instructions here. You'll notice that all these architectures which have non-fixed length instructions, the simple instructions can be 1 byte. That's the minimum size. RISC has said, we're going to sacrifice saving space in order to just make things simpler. So another thing they do is more registers. And you might say, well, that's not reduced. That's more complicated. Why would you do more registers? So the way I like thinking about this is that it's about simplifying the hardware design. And it's easier to just add more copies of registers than it is to design hardware for more instructions. And this is a way you can use all that space you would have used to implement these extra instructions. Instead, use them to have more registers and other resources like that that will just make programs faster in general. Another reason for more registers is that if you're making this choice that you have separate instructions to access memory, well, you're going to want more registers to avoid moving things to and from memory. And this was intended to sort of compensate for that. So the idea is that a good compiler, and as you can see, this is a case where they were really depending on compilers doing a good job, which wasn't a certainty at the time, would hopefully use these extra registers, and therefore these separate instructions wouldn't be a big cost. That you wouldn't have that many of them. And you're used to that now when you look at typical assembly code that compilers generate, that it like puts things in registers all the time, assuming you turn on optimizations, but rather than like pushing things on and off the stack. But so that's worked out, but it wasn't as much of a certainty in the early days of compiler writing. Another thing is that they won't have loops within single instructions. So basically, they were thinking of a hardware implementation where basically every instruction takes about the same amount of time. That's what they're going for, because that's sort of the simplest thing you can do. That doesn't mean you have to implement a RISC instruction set so every instruction takes the same amount of time, but that was what they had in mind. They also never have instructions with two memory operands, so their notion is that that if an instruction accesses memory, it does it at most once, and it does it instead of doing computation, because we have separate memory accessing instructions. And they have view addressing modes. This is part of keeping things simple. Their notion is, it's really convenient to be able to say, to have the index and scale and all things like that you see on x86, but you can simulate that with additions and shifts and so on. The compiler can take care of that. We're not trying to make assembly easy to write. We're going to keep our hardware simpler by having our instructions take one set of operands, typically. Not having this wide variety of ways you can specify a memory address. Instead, you'll have to write extra instructions to manipulate your addresses. Okay, so this is my... So overall, we have this sort of RISC is making it less work for the hardware. So the hardware is easier to design, but more work for assembly writers. And another way you can think about it is that if you see a CISC architecture, it's more likely the design philosophy was, I want this assembly language, and I'll figure out the hardware later. And if you think of a RISC architecture, it's more likely the design philosophy was, this is what my hardware is going to look like to be fast, and I'll figure out the assembly that I can build around that that's useful. And sort of probably the big practical advantage is that if you have a RISC-like design, it's just a lot easier to build and test your hardware. If you think of testing the VAX instruction set, you know, each of these instructions, if you want to write a set of tests for them, that's an awful lot of work. And if you're releasing hardware that implements this, you want to test all of these very thoroughly, or else people will be disappointed. Because how do you fix that? You go in and move, add some wires, literally a thing you might do at the time, you know. So you don't want things to be broken like that. You want to be able to test it. And if you have less instructions, it's easier to test because you can fix things in software. And sort of the notion with RISC is that you'd use this time you saved to really optimize those simple instructions. Whereas with CISC, you know, you might be more likely to say, okay, let's add instructions for the tasks that I know are important for my system. Like, that's more likely to be a thing you do. Okay, so I have this RISC-like and CISC-like, and some sources act like that this is like a hard line, that there are CISC instruction sets and there are RISC instruction sets, and that's not how it works. And a lot of the reason that isn't how it works is something that came up earlier, which is that instruction sets grow. That power, you know, used to be definitely a RISC instruction set. And now it has 1,400 instructions. And this is a thing which happens all the time, that these instruction sets evolve because people don't just get rid of an old instruction set. They say, well, I want to make a new chip, but I want to sell it. I don't want to have everyone recompile everything or get new compilers. So I'm going to implement the old instruction set, and I'm going to add some stuff to it that I think is useful. So it doesn't stay with the old design, for better or worse. And you might say, well, maybe CISC is the winner. And you might say it's the winner because, well, if you think of desktops and servers, x86 is the winner. x86 is usually considered a CISC instruction set. But, you know, this is not because the hardware designer said, yeah, CISC is the best idea for chip design. But they kind of have gone in that direction. So one thing is that Intel has added a bunch of more application-specific instructions. So that's kind of CISC-like. But if we look at the actual implementations, many of the implementations end up having aspects of RISC. So one thing is that if you look at your compilers generate usually more RISC-like instructions. You typically don't see your C or C++ compilers generating any of these complex instructions, even if they exist. Sometimes they do. And more importantly, the modern implementation technique for x86 looks kind of like a RISC machine with a translator strapped on the beginning. That there's often this translation to more modern microinstructions, which is basically a RISC machine, as sort of the first step of processing instructions. So they've sort of borrowed a lot of ideas from these RISC architectures, but they're implementing a different instruction set. And arguably that's better because now with this technique you have more flexibility. It has the disadvantage of, well, you know, that translation's relatively cheap because it turns out, as we'll learn about when we talk about pipelining, that there's a lot of like pre-processing steps for fast instruction execution, like you want to do to have a really fast desktop, you know, even for RISC. But, you know, it uses space and power, and this might be a reason why it's not done. x86 has had a harder time in sort of the low power, like mobile phone domain, maybe, depends who you talk to. But the winner, you should not think of as a judgment on CISC or RISC is a better idea, because it's really based on history. People are using x86 not because it's an awesome instruction set, but because it was there, and they want to keep using it. Okay, so any questions about RISC versus CISC? Go to my, yeah.
So let's say there's more, companies, organizations, or whatnot that like perhaps want to get more innovative or more willing to change things and don't worry about like what all the, you know, like the consumers, you know, are using? Would they be more likely? I'm assuming they'd be more likely to like be willing to go off of this or go off like old models.
So the question is, if a company like isn't constrained by history, what are they going to use? So one big factor that affects real instruction set deployment I didn't talk about is the law, in particular intellectual property rights in general. So a lot of instruction sets have patents or specifications or common implementations that are owned in some way by companies, and this affects a lot of like what instruction sets actually get used. And is a big factor. And for that reason, my guess is that like if you were an independent company, you'd probably use RISC-V because it's the one on this list which is actively developed and doesn't have and is supposed to be open specification with open implementations. But that's like it's not because it's necessarily technically superior. Like that's not the main issue. And this might go in the other way, like if you want a mobile processor, you can pay the ARM company a bunch of money and get a working ARM design that's very good to start with. And that might be a thing you do. You might use ARM just because you can buy an off-the-shelf ARM chip to start with for your design rather than going from scratch. So other questions? Yeah.
I have a question about the number of registers. So like in the context of like modern processor family, say like we can see like a quad core processor, does that mean there are like 64 registers in there?
So the question is, in the context of a modern processor, if they have multiple cores, does that mean there are 64? So let me give a caveat on this. So when I say the number of normal registers, what I mean is something we'll call, something that's sometimes called more precisely architecturally visible registers. So these are just registers that you as a programmer think exist. And it turns out, so for multiple cores, probably there have to be multiple copies. It turns out there are other reasons we might have more registers than are written down. We saw one example of them with things like ZF and SF, like where we needed extra registers but they didn't have names in assembly. And it turns out modern processors are going to have a whole bunch of extra registers as part of implementing instructions quickly that we'll see. So this is not the number of like physical registers, but yes, on a quad-core processor, we'll have at least storage for, you know, for this times 16 times 4 register values, but often we'll have even more than that because this is the number that you can see in assembly, not the number that the implementation uses. And I guess also from the other side, if we had some bizarre reason we didn't want to use registers, you could imagine the processor might implement registers by like writing values to and from memory. As long as the assembly language and the machine code didn't change, it could do that. Wouldn't make much sense. It'd be really slow, but it could do that. So that answer your question? So we're going to be using a particular instruction set for a processor implementation in this class. And that is one I've labeled here Y8664. So this is the one our textbook talks about and we're going to use for an assignment, a bunch of assignments. And we've chosen it because it's basically a simplified version of x86. You can see one way in which it's simplified is that it has 18 instructions and not 1,500. Sure is useful when you're trying to implement a processor to not implement 1,500 instructions. So let's go through the Y8664 instruction set. So I said it's most of the 1,000 plus instructions, and this is the entire set of instructions that still exist. So we have add, sub, and XOR, NOP, and so on. We'll go through each of these in a bit. And there's two special cases, which we'll start with. And you have these instructions. The other big difference from x86 is that it has a much, much simpler encoding. So we're not going to support all the types of operands that x86 has. We're not going to support the 32 and 16 and 8-bit versions of registers. And that means that we're going to be able to have a really simple encoding. And it's not a subset of the x86 encoding, because the x86 encoding is, it turns out, shockingly complicated. It does things like put the specification of what register you're using in non-contiguous places in the instruction, and other things like that, which are just needlessly annoying. So this is going to use a much simpler encoding, which will save us a lot of headache. So let's first talk about some things which are changed. So we have two instructions here, which I've listed as changed, and we have one instruction here, which most of you probably haven't seen before. Two instructions most of you probably haven't seen before. So let's start with move. So I here note that move is renamed. So how is it renamed? So move has in fact been split into multiple instructions. And the justification here is that we're going to choose our assembly language so that given the name of an instruction, you know exactly what types of operands it takes. And for move, this is a real problem because we can move a constant to a register, we can move a memory location, value in memory to a register, and so on. And we're going to split this all up into different instructions. So we're going to have two letters in front of our move to specify which type we have. The first letter specifies the source, the second specifies the destination. These are named with AT&T syntax in mind, which is why the destination is last. And we're going to put I for an immediate. Immediate means a constant value. That's what immediate means. In particular, a constant value which is going to be part of the machine code for this instruction. So an example of an immediate, if we think of x86, is like add 1 to RAX, the 1 is an immediate. We're going to have R for a register, and our only possible registers are going to be the R registers, the 64-bit registers. And we'll have an M for a location in memory. So we have all these possibilities, and we're not going to do all of them. So we're not going to allow moving to an immediate, because moving a value into a constant doesn't make any sense. So that's why all of these are grayed out and crossed out. They just don't make any sense. And you could imagine having an instruction to move an immediate to memory. We're not going to do that. We're just going to omit that instruction. And you could imagine an instruction to move memory to memory. We're going to omit that instruction. So that leaves us with these four instructions. So we have move an immediate to a register, move a register into another register, move memory into a register, and move a register into memory. So any questions on these? Yeah. So the question is, why can't you do memory to memory move? So clearly, we could make that instruction. The designers of this instruction set have decided not to include that. And probably the reason for it is the same reason it's on our list of things that RISC doesn't do. It's because it's hard, because remember RISC was trying to simplify the hardware? They're trying to simplify the hardware, so they said, that's complicated in hardware, we're not going to do it. So that's an example you can see of the hardware design informing the instruction set design. Even though clearly in like memory to memory move is a useful instruction. But they said, well, it's complicated in hardware, and well, if you need to do it, like it's not, you can use a register. You have enough to do it, it's like clearly you aren't losing functionality. Okay, so let's go to this instruction cmove, and I have cc in italics. On this diagram, whenever I use CC in italics, I mean something based on the condition code. So JCC means like jump less than, jump equal, and so on. So C move CC means C move E, C move NE, C move LE, just like all the jump variants. So something based on condition codes. So what is it? It's a conditional move. And this is something which exists on 64-bit x86, but you may have not seen it, because often compilers don't do it. And on YAD664, it's register to register only. It's the only kind of conditional move that exists. On full x86, you can do a conditional move involving memory, potentially, but not on YAD6 ever. And basically it says, if the condition is true, do the move. So here, if the greater than flags are set, meaning that we did a comparison, the result was greater, meaning that SF and ZF are false, remember our condition codes, then move RAX into RBX. So we could also write this with a conditional jump, followed by a register to register move. Any questions on this? Okay. So this is the conditional move instruction. So it exists in x86, and they've chosen to include it. It turns out it's pretty easy to implement in hardware, which is probably one reason why they included it. In particular, it's pretty easy to implement for the kind of hardware implementation we'll eventually be aiming for. So another instruction they have is halt. There's an x86 instruction which is the closest to this called HLT. You almost certainly have not seen this instruction before in x86 because it's reserved for the OS. If you try to run it in a normal program, it won't work because it will tell the OS, hey, you're not, this program was doing something it wasn't supposed to do, and your program will crash. But on x86, it's saying to stop the processor. And for the processors we'll be building, we'll use this to mark the end of the simulation of the processor. On a real processor, this would really be like put the processor to sleep until something happens, sort of thing. And the reason we need this is that, well, if you didn't have an instruction like this, we're just going to keep going. Yeah. So we just need some way of saying we're done. And we want something better than just running an infinite loop to keep wrong instructions from running. Okay. So went over the new instructions. So let's talk a little more about memory access. So first of all, there is one way, exactly one way, we can specify memory addresses that the instruction set designers have chosen to use. And that's we can use a register and an offset. This is the only possible way. Now, you can omit the offset, in which case it's zero. And we'll learn that that's going to be in the machine code. It's going to be encoded the same way. There's going to be zero written in the machine code. But this is the only possibility. So we have a base register plus an offset. You cannot do any of the other versions. They are all not valid YAD6 assembly. They're valid in x86. YAD6 just doesn't have these instructions. Okay. So that's for accessing memory. So YAD6 follows one of the RISC principles we saw before, which is that there are separate instructions for accessing memory. So RM move Q and MR move Q are the only ways to access memory, and push and pop are the only ways to access memory. So this means that if you want to add a value in memory to a register, you can't write the add instruction you do on x86 for that. That instruction in YAD6 is invalid. So what do we do instead? I want to do this. How do I do this? I'm YD6. I'm writing assembly. What should my assembly look like? Yeah. Only add what? Register. So how do I do this operation with an assembly?
So load 10 into a register.
So load 10 into a register. So 10 into a register. So some register, what register? We'll say R13 gets 10.
And then add 10 and R11 to another register.
Okay, so then, do 10 plus R11 and then dereference it. So, yeah, so that's one thing we could do. We could move 10 into R13, say. That's just an arbitrary another register. We can add R11 to that to compute the address we want to access, and then we can do an MR move Q of R13 into R13. And then we can add. And then we can add R13 to R12. So we did the same thing. We used an extra register, which we kind of can't avoid. There's a little bit of a shorter way of doing it, which is that because we support an offset on our instruction, we can load things into a register with one instruction. We can load the memory location into a register with one instruction. So the code I have here overwrites the original R11. If we didn't want to use that, we'd have to use an extra register. But this is the sort of thing you have to do. You have to use extra instructions to implement this with a separate move instruction. So another notable thing is that there's no scale. So how can we deal with this? So here we'll need something more like the technique we saw earlier of actually computing the address in a register. But how do we do that? Okay, so you want to right shift R11, and that would be great, except that it's not one of these instructions. Yes, that's a good idea. You'd think it would be one of these instructions, but it's not. So any ideas about how we could get around that? So remember, right shifting is equivalent to multiplying times 2. So you might say, okay, let's use a multiply instruction. Well, don't have one of those. But multiplying times 2 is equivalent to adding a value to itself. So a solution is to add the value to itself to multiply it times 2, then times 2 again, then times 2 again, then do the move. So you can do everything you want. Sometimes it's not super trivial, but you can do all the things you could do before. Okay, so similarly, so I mentioned that these are,
So what if you want to add 128 or something, like big number,
this one, can we use that? For the scale, so the question is, what do you want to add a big number? We have a way to move a constant into a register, as I mentioned. So that's how you can deal with big numbers. If you need to multiply a big number, well, you're going to have to write a multiply function with add.
Can we use jump to create
a... And yes, that function would probably have a loop. Yes, you can write stuff with a loop if you want to like implement multiplies in general. We're not going to do it, but I assure you, you can. You can still compute everything you could compute before. And the same with the divide. So, for constants. So I mentioned accessing memory. We only have those memory move instructions. For using constants as constants and not addresses, there is exactly one instruction which takes a constant that's not an address, and that's IRMOVEQ. And this means similarly, if you want to add one to a value, there's no add constant one instruction. It doesn't exist. Instead, you're going to have to move one into your register and then add. You need an extra register. So, you might say this is awfully inconvenient for writing assembly, but fortunately, that's not most of what you're being concerned with. You're being concerned about implementing the hardware, and it makes things simpler. And we have this general rule that there's only one kind of value for every operand of instructions, and this is why we split up the move instruction. So that rule holds even for move now that we have it as IRMOVEQ, RRMOVEQ, and so on. Each of those versions, when you look at the name, you know exactly what the operands are, exactly what values they have there. There's not multiple possibilities. This is a deliberate choice to help make the hardware simpler. Okay, so Y86 mentioned about what the instructions look like and what they take. We mentioned that there's condition codes. We saw a CMOVE, and there's also conditional jumps. So that means that we have some condition codes. We're only going to implement ZF and SF, as I mentioned earlier when we talked about condition codes. Our textbook talks about OF, but we're not going to have you implement that. And these are set by add, subtract, and an XOR. Every other instruction doesn't set them. Even if you think it should, this is just the rule. And since we implement these, here's a table you will definitely refer to some version of later, or not definite, but probably, about how the condition codes are interpreted for our instructions. And you notice that I have L, E, L, E, N, E, G, E, and G. These are the only possible versions of conditional jump and conditional move. You may have learned that x86 has some more, like JS, JA, JAE. We don't have those. These are the only ones we have. So questions on our condition codes? Okay. So conditionals, there's no compare and test instruction. Fortunately, we learned that condition codes happen with subtract, so if you want to do a compare, use a subtract instruction and ignore the result. Okay, questions? Yes. Okay, push and pop only push registers. We're not planning on having you implement push and pop in your processor, but they're in the instruction set in our textbook. So we want you to know what they do. They work like they do in x86.
Can I see the previous slide just?
Sure. And call and return are just push and pop, but they push the program counter, the address of the next instruction for call, and they pop the address and jump to it instead of putting it in the register for pop. And call, in addition to pushing a value, also jumps. So it's a jump and a push, but push of the program counter. And we don't plan on having you implement these for the processor currently, but you know, we want you to know how they work. They're not complicated. Okay, so then we have some state. So we mentioned that we work on these registers. So what do we have overall that we care about? So we snuck in this PC. So we have to know what instruction are we executing. Our processor is going to keep track of somehow the values in memory. So we have some big memory. We have our registers. It turns out we only have 15 registers. We've omitted R15. It just doesn't exist. And we don't have the smaller parts of registers. We have ZF and SF. And we'll sometimes talk about the stat, which is the processor status. Is it halted? Which we have mainly just for our simulation. We want to keep track of, do we keep running the simulation or not? So that's part of our processor state. So something you might notice about Y86 is that it's kind of RISC-like, but not completely. So it makes some of the decisions that RISC makes. Like, it definitely has simpler instructions, mostly. But push and pop and call and return, they're actually pretty complicated. Like, they do a bunch of things. But they're not like match C or those max instructions I showed you earlier. Not really complicated. We have separate instructions to access memory. That's a typical RISC decision. We have more registers, relatively speaking. Usually a small number of registers, we think of like 8. Well, that was original 32-bit x86 was that. But maybe not a huge number. We don't have looping instructions. Every instruction does one thing with a fixed size. We don't have to think that instructions are doing like a loop of things. We don't have instructions with two memory operands, and we have one addressing mode per instruction. Like, there's one possibility. There's not lots of ways of specifying operands. So it's kind of RISC-like, but we, you know, we don't have a huge number of registers. We don't have really simple instructions, and we definitely don't have fixed length instructions. And I'll show you the encoding in a bit. So questions on these RISC properties. So you can see it's kind of RISC-like, but it has some things which aren't very RISC-like. And this is what we typically see in modern architectures, that they do a lot of things that are like RISC, but often like there's something that's not very RISC-like that they do for some reason. Okay. So let's look at the encoding. So here is the encoding table, and this shows the bytes of the instructions. The instructions are variable length, so halt is 1 byte, and IRemoveQ is 10. And I show the value of each byte. When I have these two parts here, these are the two hexadecimal nibbles of the value. So NOP is hex 10 as the first byte, as its first byte. Does that make sense? So if I was writing out the bytes for instruction, we'd have NOP would have 0x10, and if it was followed by a halt instruction, the next byte in memory would be 0x00. So these instructions directly follow each other in memory. If you want to know where an instruction is, you have to figure out which line in where the next instruction is. You have to figure out which line in the table the instruction before it is to find out where that ends. Okay, we have some placeholders in this table. We'll start with these ones, CC and FN. So the CC placeholders say, if we have a conditional jump or a conditional move, what type of conditional is it? And we do something a bit funny here, which is that we have the value 0 means always. So it's the unconditional version of that instruction. So for conditional move, the unconditional version is RMoveQ, register to register move. For conditional jump, the unconditional version is jump, JMP. And we just use the same first part of the first nibble for that, but we use the second nibble to distinguish between the two. So 0 means it's just always true, meaning it's the unconditional version. Otherwise, it's LE or L or E according to this table, which is also in your textbook. Don't memorize it. And based on that, and if we have another value, it's invalid. So questions here? Yeah.
Is RMoveQ the only one that can?
Oh wait, no. So RMoveQ and jump, yeah. So notably, this means RMoveQ and CMoveXX and conditional jumps and jump share the same first line in this table. We also have this OpQ, and that represents add, subtract, and an XOR. Because they're so similar, we just differentiate them with the second nibble, and we just have a table saying which it is. And you can see that if it's 4 or more, it's not in the table, it's invalid. It's room for expansion. Okay, questions on that? So then we have these spaces for RA and RB, and these are our registers, and we encode our registers with one nibble, 4 bits, indicating which register it is, according to this table, and we use the value 15 for no register. And this is just to make the hardware simpler to implement. So for instructions like push and pop, which only take one register, we have a none in that space rather than some other placeholder. And finally, we have immediates, which are just going to be encoded in little endian at the appropriate place. For our moves, the immediates are either the offset or the constant value for I remove Q, and those are just going to be 8-byte integers, no matter how big the thing you write in assembly is. We use 8 bytes in the machine code, always. And for jump and call, the immediate is the location to jump to, and it's just after that first byte. So we'll finish up talking about the encoding next time and start talking about how the hardware implementation works.